Hello everyone, Arjun here, and once again this week we have decided to split this episode, which was initially just intended as a Patreon episode, into two halves, and the first half is going on the main feed so everyone can listen to it. And if you like what you hear and want to support us, you can always sign up to our Patreon for as little as £5 a month to listen to the whole thing. This is once again featuring frequent collaborator, at this point basically a regular feature of the podcast, Jack Frayne Reed from Real Politic, with us talking about acclaimed Hollywood writer Paul Schrader's directorial debut, Blue Collar, from 1978, starring Richard Pryor, Harvey Keitel, and Yaphet Kotto, a story about three hardworking car workers from Detroit who decide to rob their own union, and things then all go wrong. An absolutely fascinating story and a fascinating tale, particularly within the context of Paul Schrader's wider filmography. Obviously we hope you like this episode, and if you like what you hear, please do sign up to our Patreon to listen to the whole thing. Thank you very much. Cheers.
Yeah, we don't want to do anything to scare your children. That's the last thing we want to do. We don't want to scare anybody.
Hello everyone, welcome back to Leftover. This is Arjun.
And I'm Connor.
And this is the first, once again, of our Patreon episodes of this month with what seems basically a regular feature of the podcast by now. Friend of the pod, Jack Frayne Reed. How are you doing, man?
Hey man, I'm very happy to be here as always and talking about the culture with you two.
The biggest Schrader head on this podcast, actually, much to the surprise of Connor.
Yeah, I know. I'm annoyed. I'm fucking annoyed. Yeah.
I just spent like 10 minutes boring these guys.
No, you didn't bore me. I was just like, I should have marathoned them all before the episode.
Yes, because after all, we are today discussing the directorial debut of longtime Martin Scorsese collaborator and legendary Hollywood writer and director Paul Schrader, Blue Collar, which was directed in 1978. I saw it for the first time before this recording, so I'm probably gonna have the sort of freshest perspective on it. But it's a fascinating film, particularly as I was mentioning, in the context of all the strikes that are going on around the country right now. It's a film very much about the American working class at the sort of tail end of the 70s, just before Reaganomics sort of completely destroys it. Did you guys, like, in your sort of rewatches, like, is that something that you guys sort of picked up on as well?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it certainly right now has more of a jaded view of industrial action and the labor movement than maybe many of us are feeling. This is not a Mick Lynch maniac film, you know.
Absolutely not. It's very much the opposite. Very much the opposite.
Yeah, it's not praising the good Zelensky. It's kind of, but I think it's more interesting and nuanced in its critique of the trade unions than most American films that deal with trade unions, which are just like they're basically just a front of the mafia and they don't really do anything else.
Yeah, and it's also, as a film, it's not what you'd call necessary. It's not like a traditional Hollywood movie where it's like anti-worker, like this movie. Yeah. Like what shocked me most about this movie that you haven't really gotten Hollywood movies, at least mainstream Hollywood movies, over the last 40 years, is just seeing the lives of working people just plain as is. Having, you know, to see Harvey Keitel work two jobs to pay for, you know, his daughter's braces and, like, you know, Zeke and you know, lying to the IRS just to make sure you can get a little bit of extra money. You know, like, it's, you don't, as you say, with Reaganomics and, like, I'd say the birth of the blockbuster and franchise film, Hollywood didn't want to make movies like this. Like, after New Hollywood tanked with the Heaven's Gate, they were like, nope, no more movies like that that actually portray, you know, regular people, which that's the thing that shocked me most about it.
It's like something similar to, like, The Deer Hunter, for example.
Yeah.
You know, like, in that kind of portrayal of, like, that, a very... sort of iconic image of the American working class, you know, like works in auto factories, and obviously cars being like the symbol of the American dream, you know, like very much, you know, personifies that. And yeah, this sort of delusion that it has towards unions and things like that. Yeah, I think it is quite an interesting critique that it has, because I think it is still very much a pro-worker film, and it comes to the conclusion of how, you know, structures like the union are also co-opted by the structures of capitalism, and how they are, you know, co-opted in order to keep the working class constantly fighting each other over, you know, things like race and so on.
It could not be more explicit about that.
Yeah, I mean that's literally, they say that twice in the
film. Yeah.
And that's the thing with, like, the movie. I'm full spoiler alert for people who haven't seen the movie. Watch the movie before you listen. But, like, also, like, the movie doesn't have a happy ending for, you know, the two protagonists who do survive. You know, like, one of them rats to the FBI, and then the other, you know, he basically gets paid to go up a position, but they're both fundamentally unhappy with what's happened. Yeah. And then it leads to the ending, and it's sort of like, you know, it's not like a clear cut of these guys got out scot-free and they got everything they wanted, even though, like, you know, Zeke technically got what he wanted. Like, he's not happy about it, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, Smokey died as well. Like, and, like, I think the ending definitely signifies that Smokey was, like, the moral backbone of the three.
Yeah.
Like, that's the impression I got.
Absolutely. And so, like, Richard Pryor's character at the end of all the stuff that happens in the film, he gets made the shop steward by the union, right?
Mm.
And he offers, he offers Harvey Keitel's character, who has not yet ratted them all out to the FBI, the position of foreman. So they both get a promotion, and effectively they, you know, get, within this scenario, both get bought off for their friend and comrade's very, very suspicious death. Which, yeah, I forgot that he died in the movie. I was watching it, like, he's going to smash his way to the window. He's going to get out of this one.
Yeah, no, horrific.
It's a really shocking
A slow, drawn-out, horrible death.
Yeah, it's genuinely, like, quite hard to watch.
Yeah. And Richard Pryor's like, nothing we can do now is going to bring back Smokey. And I just feel like when you're at the point of saying, like, nothing you can do is going to bring back your dead friend who's been killed, you know, by mortal enemies, you're at the stage of, like, total surrender and capitulation. Yeah. That's not a thing you say if you're not going to do something kind of amoral.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think if anyone has seen, let's say, you know, Sorry to Bother You by Boots Riley, from, I think that was 2018, 2019.
Around that time.
It kind of, like, deals with similar themes of, like, organizing as well, and about, like, how companies will try to sort of buy off the people that are trying to kind of agitate. And what's interesting, especially with this film, like, having watched it for the first time, with, like, someone like Richard Pryor, who is, you know, one of the, you know, most well-known stand-up comics of all time, and just, like, this natural comedic delivery, even when he's, like, talking about quite serious things, you know, like, he is just, like, there's this kind of, like, sharpness to, like, the way that he says it, to the way that he says things, which is just kind of, like, naturally just quite funny.
Yeah,
definitely.
So, like, right in the first scene, I was just going to say, like, in the first scene where the union is where the union rep is speaking to the workers, and Zeke is like the main guy who's kind of standing up and then challenging the union, saying that the union isn't actually doing anything for them, to talking about the fact that his locker is broken and that he's had to, he's cut his finger how many times, like, trying to open the locker. He's spent $20 on ball pens trying to open that locker. And, you know, it, like, the absurdity of the situation there as well. And, like, the sort of almost physicality of, like, the things that he's talking about. And then that kind of followed up by the sort of the infamous party scene, the cocaine party scene.
yeah, that was like, not fake cocaine, was it?
Oh, yeah. I think it's interesting how, like, the tone shifts between that at the start of the film and then this almost, like, kind of comedic crime caper where things kind of go wrong to this, like, really cynical and dark ending. Like,
yeah.
And it's a very depressing and dark ending, like you were saying. It has no delusions about what kind of, idea it has.
Well, you're totally right that Richard Pryor brings a lot of the comedy to the film, although he proves himself to be a very capable dramatic actor. He improvised heavily during the making of the film, so a lot of the stuff that he's saying was quite possibly, I'm not even written by Schrader or written by Schrader, but with Pryor's own embellishments. So that probably upped the comedy quotient a lot, because I love Schrader. I don't think of many of his films as that funny, apart from maybe the underrated Dog Eat Dog. But the other thing is, like, what's kind of interesting about this film, and something I think that's good about it, is that of the three main characters, two of them are black and one of them is white.
The casting is super interesting.
Yeah, and there's plenty of white workers at this auto plant where they work, but Harvey Keitel gravitates towards these two black guys, and they get on like a house on fire. Although in real life, that was not the case with the actors, which I'm sure we'll return to. They're such good friends. And then after Yaphet Kotto's character Smokey has been killed, the final bit of dialogue in the film before they repeat that line, over the final freeze frame is Harvey Keitel and Richard Pryor screaming racial epithets at each other across the shop floor. And then, they state straight up, like, we should read the quote, shouldn't we? Because we already alluded to it.
I think I had it typed up on the notes, because it's a great quote. Oh, yeah, it's like, they'll do anything to keep you on their line. They pit the lifers against the new boys, the old against the young, the black against the white, everybody to keep us in our place. But that's the line that plays twice in the movie, and like it's like the exclamation point at the end of the movie, and it's like, oh, okay, I get what the movie's trying to say.
Yeah. So it's not like, just in case anyone misinterpreted that scene and thought it's saying, oh, it's just human nature that people are gonna be at each other's throats like this. It's like, no,
the film has shown
that these guys have very much in common, but it's capitalism that pits them against each other in this brutal dog-eat-dog way. The underrated film.
By the end of this episode, we will have had to, like, sneak in the title of every one of Schrader's other films.
Maybe there's a left analysis lurking in Dog Eat Dog. I have to rewatch it.
All I know
between all those gratuitous N-words they're constantly saying throughout the film.
All I know is I'll be a light sleeper when I'm editing this podcast. That's the thing about the movie. It's just, it's really, because like when I first watched it, I was like, oh, is this movie like anti-union? But like, I don't even know. I don't think it is necessary. As you say, it's like a nuanced movie in that way. And I think it's like going into those anxieties before Reaganomics that people did have with like the corruption of, because you know the stereotype of American like unions like in the media, it's like they're ran by the mob and all that stuff.
Even the
best Simpsons episode about how unionizing gets in the dental plan has plenty of like Italian American union jokes. it's So it, like, it does tap, but like the characters never say like, oh, we hate the union. Like Harvey Keitel, his character Jerry, like he says he's a proud union man. There's the bit in the movie where he says like he was on strike for 90 days in 73 and how like, you know, he's still recouping the costs from that, but like it was worth it because like he likes the union. And like I said, Zeke says he's like, I'd rather stand in your place in the union. And like at the beginning when he's talking about the pen. So it's like, they're like, I think they don't hate the union itself. They hate like the guys who are running it, who are like, because there's a really interesting scene, which on rewatch, it might be my favorite scene in the film because of how like grim it is. But when you have the old union rep talking to Zeke on the bridge.
And
he does that intimidation tactic where he's like, if it wasn't for me, you know, you wouldn't be in this factory sort
that's a really kind of shocking bit where he's being more friendly and paternalistic and then just like the entitlement, you know, it all comes out and just like the bad paternalism. He's just like, you know, a few years ago, we didn't have any blacks working in the factory. And you know, Richard Pryor is almost like taken aback by this, and it seems like he's gonna go into a kind of like racial attack on him. Then he pulls it back, and he's clearly keeping him in his place by saying it was guys like me who worked to get black people in the union and working on the shop floors. You owe me.
Yeah, it like that's fair. Like first time I watched it, I was like, oh, that's pretty good. But on rewatch, I was like, oh, that is hot. Like,
that scene is really, really well done. I think it gets the point across.
Yeah.
And I think that's what's interesting is like that sort of disillusionment with the people running the union. I think ultimately draws into this critique of like the structures of the unions themselves being the problem. You know, it's not.
Yeah.
Like, it's not that, like, it's about individuals running it. It's about, like, the way that these unions are, you know, structured in this, like, very undemocratic way. Mm. And, you know, we've seen issues with some of the big unions, like, in this country as well, even very recently as well. You know, I think, like, obviously, as leftists, we are all, like, we should always be pro-worker. We should always be, you know, pro-organized labor, absolutely. But at the same time, it's important for us to not look at this stuff with, like, this rose-tinted glasses and to also like identify and recognize where, you know, these structures have problems as well, you know. And then obviously we should try to do better, but yeah, like I mean I think we have sort of obviously talked a lot about like some of the broader things that happen in this film, but I think to give a sort of to give more of a context for everything that's going on. I mean, like the film itself focuses on three, as we've mentioned, you know, three workers at this car factory in somewhere in Michigan. I think, is it supposed to be
It's
in Detroit?
Detroit. It's Detroit.
It is set in Detroit, right? Okay, yeah. Oh no, of course. Yeah, yeah. It's got the sign like the Detroit car production.
And they're bordering on Canada and stuff. Like,
exactly.
They're right in the middle of Rust Belt America, where the biggest car manufacturing is. Yeah.
And I mean, Detroit is obviously was Motor City, and I mean that's where like that was the heart of American auto production. So the film itself was also filmed on site at a car factory in Kalamazoo, Michigan.
Cool.
I mean, it has the three main characters: Zeke, played by Richard Pryor; Jerry, played by Harvey Keitel, who plays, I'm guessing, a Polish. Polish American worker. Jerry Bartowski sounds very Polish to me. And then Yaphet Kotto playing Smokey James, who's just a brilliant character.
Oh, I love him.
And just like he's played so well as well.
I love when he's like negotiating with the junkie about the watch. That's such a good scene. He's like, I'm only giving it to you for this price because you're my man. He's like, if I'm your man, am I? I'm only gonna give you $10 for that.
as mentioned, the sort of moral backbone of the film as well. They are good friends, and As mentioned as well, I think they were called the Oreo Gang because it's two black guys and one white guy. And just in terms of casting for like a major Hollywood production, especially at the time, and even now, it wouldn't be, it's not that common that you see that, right?
No.
And I think something that I read about this film is that Paul Schrader basically told each of the three leads that they were the main character.
They're all super pissed about it when they found out it was basically an ensemble drama.
And that led to many infamous scenes of tension during the filming of Blue Collar. Which, of course, included Richard Pryor at some point pulling a gun on Paul Schrader.
Yeah. I mean, like, this is kind of like that's it was because he wanted him to do more than three takes. This is like some Clint Eastwood shit, you know. He hates more than one take.
Yeah.
But I don't think Clint actually would pull a gun on someone. I think he, contrary to popular beliefs, doesn't like guns. He just, like, literally bite your head off or something.
Yeah. I don't know. Clint Eastwood gives me the impression if he'd have a quiet word with you and, like, it would be the most devastating thing you've ever heard in your life.
Just would be like, shut up, pussy.
You just walk away with all the colour drained from your face.
Legit. Like, if I got told off by Clint Eastwood, it would be, like, the most calm telling off of my life and I would be heartbroken.
we used to stack fucks like you miles high in Korea.
Yeah, and all of the characters are going through their own individual turmoils throughout the film, which is sort of the main instigator. So as we've kind of alluded to, basically, Zeke is in money troubles. So, like, the locker thing isn't the main issue, but, like, basically he lied to the IRS about how many children he had. And,
This is a scene that Paul Schrader himself expressed a great deal of regret about.
Yeah, he said it played into the trope of, like, black people being benefit cheats, didn't he?
Exactly.
I mean, it is the most explicitly comedic scene in the film, probably. Then it actually turns very
sad
because, like, Richard Pryor's like, I can't fucking pay for my kids. Like, I can't pay the bills, man.
So, like, as you said, even though it's, like, kind of comedic, like, that bit at the end when he's, like, hugging his wife, he has, like, the worst look of sadness I've ever seen a character have in a movie. Like, because it is devastating. Like, is it something like $2,000 he has to pay in back taxes? Something like that? Like, money he does not have. And as I said, Jerry's basically having to work two jobs, one at a gas pump to pay for his daughter's braces. And there's a very horrible scene in the movie where she tried to do makeshift braces, which is because he kept which I forgot about on my rewatch. I was like, oh yeah, that scene, that's interesting.
That's so grim. She comes down with her mouth all covered in blood.
And then Smokey is essentially into debt with loan sharks. I forget specifically what for, but so they all have.
I don't think they explain it. Go into too much of an explanation about, like, what the debts are in the film.
Yeah,
they're like those Dago loan sharks. They go for your family, like.
Yeah, like, I mean, he at some point gets in this car and there's a guy, like, sitting behind him and he clearly owes him a lot of money and he's clearly, like, quite a dangerous guy. Like, that's the impression that the film gives. I think they kind of, like, leave it at that.
But just like that junkie on the street, though, he actually likes Smokey. He's like, you're my man, that's why that's why I'm not fucking killing your family or whatever. Because you always pay up on time, you know, he's never missed a payment or whatever.
But that does lead to, like, I said, probably my actual, like, favorite, like, not even fun, but it's, like, probably the most, like, action in the movie when Smokey basically waits at Jerry's house for two loan sharks
with a baseball bat.
like, that scene is, like, probably the closest to an action scene in the movie, apart from the car chase at the end. Like, that's, like, And it's a great scene as well, just like the way as soon as they're in there and they see him and they're like, oh, is this the wrong house?
So those guys are thugs sent by the union, though, aren't they?
Oh yeah, they're union thugs. But it's because the loan shark ratted them out, didn't he, to the police? I think it was that guy who ratted the three of them out.
Yeah. Like they're in the car with him, and like the next scene, he's like, the police have taken him in for some
bullshit. Oh, I completely forgot about that. Exactly.
And he's just like, I can give you these three nobodies like, who are way in over their heads.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, obviously, because these three characters are all in their various financial troubles, they hatch a plot. They hatch a plot to rob their own trade union, which Paul Schrader, I think, called such an act of self-harm, such a ridiculous act of self-harm or something along those lines.
Yeah.
Just to kind of, like, show how... how organized labor in America in that sort of context had been, co-opted and corrupted in a way as well. Mm. How it had kind of disillusioned workers to kind of fight against their own self-interest, basically, right? And they kind of come to the conclusion that there's the safe that they're going to rob.
Yeah, they see this massive safe and they think, oh, this is going to have loads of money in it.
Oh, but before that, I think it's important to talk about the cocaine party, right?
Yeah.
Like that really kind of like sets the kind of stage for like the friendship between these characters, even though, like mentioned, like the actors themselves, like they could barely ever be, like they had to like have a lot of convincing to do to get all three actors on the couch at the same time in that one shot, like when it's like light outside and like it's the end of the party.
That's a brilliant sequence where they're all so like burned out from a night doing cocaine and having sex with sex workers and they are just like lying there like all just kind of staring straight ahead with these vacant coked gazes, smoking cigarettes and just talking. They're letting one another monologue about how shit their lives are and how broke they are, and it's great. Like Richard Pryor,
it's such a brilliant scene,
just say what his problem is and they'll all just stare ahead, and Harvey Keitel will say what his problem is, etc. You know, it's really good. And it's just, there's some real comedy in that sequence as well, especially when Yaphet Kotto is, like, making excuses to go out and cheat on his wife. He's just telling her, like, oh, I've got to go to the pump. They need me at the pump.
No, that's Keitel, yeah.
That's Keitel.
Oh, sorry, Keitel, yeah.
Yeah. Richard Pryor is telling his wife... What does he tell his wife again? It's also like, and his wife obviously knows that like he's full of shit. They go anyway, and I think it really kind of plays into that that image of this hard-working fucked over man, like as the lyrics of the opening song goes.
Yeah, by Captain Beefheart.
Yeah.
But also, I realized that, like, I just remembered the scene when they're in the bar and you have the FBI guy pretending to be a student.
So funny. Yeah.
And, like,
so good.
That what shows you do, what you do when Mason walks up to you at a conference and he's like, so, can you tell me what Momentum's latest plans are?
But, like, I think that's the scene where Keitel says that, like, he was on the picket line for 90 days and stuff.
Exactly.
Yeah. And, like, that solidifies. Like, Keir Starmer. To the union. Yeah.
He's worked. He's been a trade unionist all his life.
This FBI guy who shows up as an educator.
Doing a doctoral thesis on.
So great. It's just, like, so what's our plans for world domination, eh, guys?
I think Richard Pryor says, a thesis? Yeah. What? Is that a sex thing?
Yeah, I love how Smokey immediately knows he's full of shit. Exactly. Like, he's just like, this guy's FBI. Like, he's
he actually is FBI. Harvey Keitel just
wrote. Because Smokey has spent time in prison, and I think Smokey just like has that instinct better than the other guys.
He knows a PhD.
He's also ex-army as well, right?
Yeah, he is. Yeah, I think he was in Vietnam, I think they say.
Yeah, that would
be it.
But, like, I think he says at some point that, because why would, like, a guy doing a doctoral thesis just go into a random, like, bar, like, in the middle of
the thing?
Stop paying
for drinks.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, then start, like, agitating, start asking questions. So, like, this union that's supposed to be representing you, it's not doing a very good job, is it?
It's British journalism. That bit is literally fucking, like, Kay Burley interviewing Mick Lynch.
It's incredible.
So why do you suck? Why are you a little fascist who wants to drag us back to the 1970s, you prick?
They should start pretending they're doing doctoral theses. They're like, oh, I'm just you know, like, they're just like Steve Buscemi with the skateboard, and it's like, how do you do, fellow workers? I'm doing a thesis on your train union. Can you give me some details about where you're doing? Yeah.
What would be the equivalent of a skateboard?
Matthew Goodman energy.
Just a big tool that they're clearly buckling under the weight of, just over their shoulder.
Yeah.
A spanner.
Just has grease on their forehead and like some tissue. Hanging out of their denim over, like, their denim jeans. I was gonna say different clothing, but I forgot I'll cut that out.
They've got some overalls in the film.
Overalls, right? That's it. Overalls? Yeah, over their their denim overalls.
Yeah.
But yeah, like, they decide to hatch this plan, right, to rob the bank. Not to rob the bank, to rob the union.
Yeah.
To rob this safe, because they know it's not going to be guarded particularly well either. And they go and they rob it, and there's only petty cash in there, just a few $100s.
Yeah.
But much more valuable is the notebook they find in there, which has information about a lot of shady dealings within the union.
Illegal loans.
Illegal loans and connections to the organized mob.
Mob ties, as Drake would
mob
say.
Ties, yeah. Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
With his extensive organized crime links.
Yeah, no. Yeah, so like they're like, I don't remember the specific details, but I'm guessing their plan from that point is to try and blackmail the union and get an insurance payout from you know, the money that's been through illegal loans and all that sort of stuff.
The union claimed that much more money had been stolen.
Oh, that's so funny when the head of the union is on he's on TV and doing a press conference, and the journalist is just like, is it true that the money stolen was in excess of like $6 million or something? And he just takes a big pause. He's like, it may well have been.
Oh, so good. I love it.
Yeah, because they realize that, like, they could, like, the union realizes they can scam the insurance to
get more money out of it.
So, like, it just becomes like this whole kind of, like, you know, scamming the scammers kind of game. And then, like, they decide, okay, they're going to blackmail the union for, like, the whole amount that they're claiming, basically. As they hatch this plan, they sort of start getting cold feet and realize that they may be in well over their heads, because the union is certainly not going to let this just go unchallenged.
And by the union, it's mainly specifically the old head of the union and
Eddie Knuckles.
Yeah, Eddie
Who plays
Knuckles.
Him?
I don't know.
He's got
but
an
he's
amazing
really
face. Amazing.
Yeah,
Robert Prosky kind of face, like, where? Blue collar. Let's look this up, because that guy is dope. You don't get faces like that anymore.
Well,
human beings have evolved past that.
What I love about that character is that, like, he does seem very approachable. There's a scene where Zeke sees him to talk about the locker, and he gets on the phone to the guy, and he's like, "Can you make sure Zeke's locker is fixed?" And all this stuff, and he's doing this whole spiel about, he's like, I look out for all my guys.
Yeah,
exactly.
That stuff. Yeah. Like, and then which makes that scene on the bridge hit even harder when you're like, oh fuck, he's just full of shit.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah, his name is Harry Beliver.
Ah, okay.
That's the actor.
Oh yeah, like Eddie Johnson.
But the movie does definitely make a good point of, like, you know, you should shift about union leadership, you know, every once in a while.
Yeah.
As you say, even like the old guy who fought for your rights, after a while he's gonna have some, you know, biases or something happen. Like, it's good to mix it up and get someone new every, you know, few years. You can't just have the same guy be the union leader for like 30 years.
Yeah. Like, also, he might just be bullshitting about how it was fucking him who got black people.
He's 100%. Because it was, you know, the solidarity amongst the union that would have done that. But because he's got this, you know, he's been in power for so long, he's like, oh, you know, because of me, this happened and sort of thing. And like, it's given him that kind of path, and that he's like, oh, I'm such a good person because I did this for you.
Yeah.
Like, it's that condescending kind of thing. Very good scummy character. Like, you don't get any characters like that anymore.
Did you two clock Ed Begley Jr. in it much? Who was he? Was he the foreman who...
was just one of the... floor workers. Just,
was he the guy who drove...
One of the factory workers.
Was he the guy who drove the into the coke machine?
That was an older guy. This was quite a young Ed Begley Jr. And like, he's just like the tall guy. Like, I can't remember if he does anything sort of note in the film, but I just kept on recognizing him as Ed Begley Jr.
That's the interesting thing about this movie. Apart from like the three main characters, you just got a lot of sort of background actors who haven't really been in much, or at least probably more character actors or non-actors. Like,
yeah,
I can't really name anyone else apart from the main three who I've seen in, like, they've probably been in a bunch of stuff from the 70s and so on, but like, they are very much, you know, not to the forefront. It is mainly those three cars. And I wouldn't be surprised if a lot of the background extras are actually real, you know, auto workers. It wouldn't surprise me.
No, not at all. No, I was looking at the filmography, rather, of that Harry Beliver guy. I don't think I've seen anything he was in apart from this.
So
he was in films for decades. His first film role was in 1939.
Oh, okay.
So that's a lot of stuff that I've missed.
Fair.
I love that there's a guy called... But it's the foreman, isn't he? He's nicknamed Dogshit. Dogshit Miller.
Oh, yeah, that Dogshit Miller. He's probably the biggest piece of shit in the movie. Like, from an outward perspective, like, because he's, like, he's got racial biases. He's just, like, a dick to everyone who works, and mainly just the black workers in the factory.
Like, well, doesn't Richard Pryor like threaten to kill him or something? I can't remember.
Like, there's that meeting where they're in the room with the union rep and the foreman, and like, they're arguing about, like, and they say to Zeke, "Oh, buy him, I don't know if it's a drink or something," and he's like, "Why should I buy him?
Buying him shit." And he actually gets it. So that, like, for threatening to kill his foreman, he gets like a bottle of champagne bought for him by the foreman, and that's so funny. That's trade unionism done right. Yeah. You know, that negotiation.
Yeah,
the worker wins.
Okay, you buy him a drink instead, and you call it quits.
It's literally Richard Pryor. Like, he lost nothing from that situation. Yeah. Like, the guy went in like, okay, can we fire him? And that's like what they went in with. Like, we're gonna fire him. And then the union's like, oh, well, I don't know, we take a very tough line on firings. So they're like, okay, buy him a bottle. And he's like, no. And they're like, okay, you get a bottle bought for you. How is that? How's that as an alternative to being fired? Yeah, okay, cool.
Like, that scene alone shows the movie is pro-union.
Yeah. Absolutely.
And I was going to say as well, apparently that particular scene, the one in the bar towards the beginning, when they meet the FBI agent who's come undercover as an instructor. That was it, an instructor. that apparently, like, that's when...
CIA interrogation instructor. Exactly. Just back from El Salvador.
Because, like, Harvey Keitel would need a few takes to warm up. So normally, and Richard Pryor would only do like three takes max.
Yeah, because he needs to go off and do more cocaine. Like, man was a major drug addict. His time is finite.
And he would start, like, well, he blamed this film for putting him back on the cocaine, which is debatable.
All the films that I come on the show to cover seem to be like majorly coked out late
cocaine. Maybe that's something for the psychiatrist.
was Schrader doing coke at this time?
I don't know. Like, was Schrader a major coke fiend? Yes, he was.
Because he grew up with this very repressed religious upbringing, and then in the 70s, or maybe the late starting the late 60s, he discovered cocaine and having lots and lots of sex, and I think that took up a few years of his life.
Which is funny, because I think I read somewhere Paul Schrader didn't see his first movie until he was 18 or something.
He came from this super strict Calvinist background, which is one of the most guilt-laced Christian sects.
Mate. I lived in the Netherlands, and they are a strange. Yeah. They're a strange people.
There's a reason. Like blue collar is probably one of the not one of the only, but it's one of the main outliers in Schrader's filmography that doesn't really deal with religion as kind of like this thing that occupies the character's mind.
Yeah.
Like, say hardcore First Reformed, even like Absolutely. The Card Counter in a way deals with guilt, you know, like kind of, you know, there's always this feeling of religious guilt in most of his filmography, even like, you know, the whole God's Lonely Man kind of thing, you know, someone who's, you know, doing the work for God, like Travis Bickle, like he sees almost as what he's doing is like a
cleaning the streets in a great biblical flood.
He sees it as like a religious act. He's like, you know.
And of course, Scorsese has a fucked up relationship with religion as well. So Taxi Driver just has that shit in spades.
That's why whenever they collaborate, it's a banger of a movie. Like, you got Catholic guilt and you got Calvinist guilt. Like,
the great unification.
And of course, Schrader's follow-up to this was Hardcore, which you mentioned, Connor, which is all about a character who Schrader said was based on his father, who's the father of a missing girl who ends up in the world of pornography, and he goes out to San Francisco, I think, to try and get her. And you know, as you can imagine, a film called Hardcore is about, it's all about this very devout, very repressed character dealing with a kind of a hypersexual world that has got far too close to home for his comfort. Mm.
Yeah, there's the very famous scene that I'm pretty sure, even if you haven't heard of Hardcore, everyone's seen the scene of George C. Scott in the cinema shouting, "Turn it off." That's where it's from.
Because
the scummy private investigator played by Peter Boyle's like, "I found a film you might want to see to know where your daughter is."
Yeah, you can't just say, "Oh yeah, by the way, your daughter's in this pornographic film." You probably
he has to
probably
show
don't
it
want
to
watch
him.
Your daughter fucking some guy. It doesn't occur to him. He's like, "You got to watch this film. There's a little surprise in it for you."
I've only seen the first two thirds of it. From what I've seen, it is very good.
Yeah, it is. It absolutely is.
The poster for the film has just the line, "Oh my God, that's my daughter."
I want that poster because it's so good.
That's awesome.
And a picture of the main character with both his, his face in both his hands.
So. But Blue Collar is like it's an interesting outlier. And I think, obviously, I don't know how much of it is true, but I think Paul Schrader has disowned this movie.
Like, yeah.
I think, I don't know if it's like the quality of the movie, or maybe it's just the set experience he had on it. Like, because apparently he very much relied on like the cinematographer and like heads of departments to get himself through the movie, because obviously he had never directed a movie before. And like, imagine this being the first movie you direct when you have three clashing egos.
Yeah, yeah, where, definitely. Like, well, he had a nervous breakdown, didn't he? But after Fryer pulled the gun on him.
Yeah, like that will do it to you, you know.
Especially if you've seen this Richard Pryor stand up bit where he's talking about the mafia, and pulling the gun on the mafia.
That is
shit
one
that normally scared the whitey to death. And I don't know, like maybe he is specifically talking about when he pulled a gun on Paul Schrader.
That is absolutely one of the funniest bits of stand-up I've ever seen. The Rich Pryor mafia bit.
It is incredible. It is incredible.
Yeah. I'm going to have to watch that after this podcast. It's on YouTube. You sold me at mafia.
Yeah, just Richard Pryor mafia joke.
All his comedy specials are worth a watch, I think. There's only like three made during his lifetime or something. And then there's this one that came out later, which is like footage of him in the early 70s, but to be honest, it's not as good. He hasn't quite developed his style yet. Like, obviously this film was released, let me look up actually his discography, because like Richard Pryor should have got Phil Spector to produce one of his comedy albums. They could have just held each other up at gunpoint the entire time. So this was basically just like going up to his... This was like right... This film came out right in his kind of imperial phase of stand-up. So his special... what's the special called? Just like Richard Pryor Live in Concert came out the following year, and he released in 1978 Wanted Live in Concert, among various other releases, some of which are probably like unauthorized shit. I think the Laugh Records ones are unauthorized shit, but yeah, he'd basically that was like a double LP set. So that was him really, you know, giving the people what they wanted from his 1978 tour. But prior to that, he'd released a series of very, very influential records in the early to mid 70s, almost all of which feature the N-word in the title.
See, like, I think the only other thing, because I haven't seen a lot of things with Richard Pryor, the only other thing I've seen him in is his brief appearance in Lost Highway.
Oh, yeah, by which point...
Towards the end of his life, because I think he's like wheelchair bound in that movie.
Yeah, he had multiple sclerosis, I think. So he's very frail in that film.
Yeah, like I think it was one. I think it might have been his last role.
I think
like,
so.
One off. Yeah, like that's the only other thing I've seen him in. Like, I think that was the first thing I'd see, because I haven't seen Superman 3, and I haven't seen the stand ups. So it's just like that was like my first proper exposure to him, and like you know, then you obviously see Blue Collar. And a standout performance, you know, like, so fucking good. Like,
interestingly, just the year before Blue Collar, Pryor had starred in this remake of an Italian comedy film called The Seduction of Mimi, which was called Which Way Is Up? This film features a prominent subplot about an orange picker played by Richard Pryor, who also plays the orange picker's father and a reverend who gets the orange picker's wife pregnant. So it's him doing... Who was the actor who it was kind of like in their contract that they had to play loads of... Oh, Peter Sellers. Like Sellers
Doctor Strangelove.
Yeah,
was he doing a Doctor Strangelove?
Yes, exactly. They really wanted to like cash in on the Pryor brand and have him play as many characters as possible. But this film has this whole subplot about like the orange pickers all go on strike and Pryor's character's in love with one of the labor organizers. You know, I can't remember much about it, but. it's got some trade union stuff in there too.
Okay, fair. But that's the thing with like 70s movies in general. I always feel like I'm nagging, saying that most mainstream cinema is in the pits. But it's like, it was like a brief period, a brief decade where you did get these movies, at least in a mainstream way, that weren't independent.
Well, it's the golden era of Hollywood, isn't it?
Yeah, like that new Hollywood era where it was movies about like the world. Like Five Easy Pieces with Jack Nicholson.
Yeah.
Like, most of the Hal Ashby movies.
The Landlord, really good film.
Yeah, and like, even The Last Detail, I know it's about Navy guys, but they're still like going on like a fucking drink around town sort of thing. And like, it was just this decade that was very like, it just portrayed the working man. And like, it's funny, from when I watched Hardcore, I always like seeing Hardcore as like one of those last movies, because in that movie you constantly see posters of Star Wars and Star Wars memorabilia everywhere, and I'm like, oh, it's a signifier of the end of an era of movies, at least in the mainstream.
Hey, well, it's... at least there was still pornographic cinema, you know, playing movie theaters.
But
which you would take your first, which you would take your first date to.
Taxi
character.
Yeah, maybe Schrader had a bit of a fascination with porn theaters and stuff. I don't know. Maybe that was, maybe he visited them a lot when he when he was just kicking Calvinism.
Yeah, because well, when I don't know how much of it is obviously hyperbole on Schrader's part, because he is definitely someone who exaggerates. But like when he was writing Taxi Driver, wasn't he basically like living in his car and like?
He was
a taxi driver for a bit.
Yeah,
wanted to get in the role. No, I don't know. I'd like.
No, I know he was like, he had really bad alcoholism in like the mid early 70s, and he was like living in his car, and like he wrote Taxi Driver, and I think obviously Scorsese, he was like, this is a really good script, I'm gonna make this. From what I hear of it, like. I don't know if it's one of those things that's like urban legend, how so many, you know, movies have these like stories that like, you know, the filmmakers push. A lot of it is, you get that with most filmmakers though, they exaggerate the way they made the movie, like how, you know, Tarantino's like, oh, making Reservoir Dogs was such a hard journey to get there, when it was just Harvey Keitel saying, I like this script, I'll give you money for it.
Yeah, well, I mean, it helped, I think, that Schrader had a bit of a rep. Like, I think he was a film critic before he was ever a film. Kind of, he was, like, mentored by Pauline Kael, effectively. So he always had a pretty heavyweight endorsement in her.
Well, he wrote a book that I studied in my MA called, like, Transcendental Style in Film, in which he analyzes, like, films by Ozu and Robert Bresson and stuff. And, like, his later movies, like First Reformed and Card Counter, have very much gone into his theoretical right. Like, those films he wrote about, he's definitely emulating that style now in his most recent movies, at least. Because, like, before that, his movies were sort of all over the place in style, but now they're very... Card Counter and First Reformed, very similar minimalist kind of... I don't know the word for it, but yeah. But, yeah, Blue Collar's the biggest outlier in his filmography, at least. Unless you count, like... The Exorcist prequel. Even then, that ties into religion. So,
religion.
Like, yeah, that, it's not a Schrader joint, really. It doesn't feel like he really has much attachment to it. But it's, I mean, speaking of First Reformed and The Card Counter, it's kind of astonishing how good those films are. I mean, he's, what, 76 now?
Yeah.
75. And, he had a long period where he was effectively in the wilderness. Like, I mean, The Walker was quite acclaimed actually, but he didn't have like really a major kind of critical hit between, commercial hits have never really been his thing. Between Autofocus and First Reformed, that's 15 years. 15 years in the wilderness with one kind of well-received film in there. Yeah, these films are, you know, they're not just good, they're not just solid late period work, they're actual masterpieces that are as good as anything he did as a younger man. They sum up so much of what he's been trying to say all these years.
And also, like, especially with First Reformed and The Card Counter, and even Blue Collar to an extent, even though, like, there's a quote that he said that, like, about Blue Collar, that it isn't, a left-wing film specifically, and like Schrader's politics are definitely inconsistent.
Yeah.
But then Card Counter and First Reformed are some of the most, like, at least on a like American film in the most recent years, some of the most politically sound American films.
Yeah.
In the last, like, Card Counter is fully critical of, like, you know, soldiers who tortured in Iraq. And, like, First Reformed is literally saying, you know, climate change is here.
And and capitalism is responsible for
yeah,
it.
Yeah, literally.
And,
like,
and, so. And the Iraq War also figures prominently in First Reformed.
Yeah, because it's, like, it's definitely on the forefront. So for someone who, like, he doesn't like to refer to himself as a political filmmaker, he touches on it a lot more than most filmmakers would even hint at least currently. And I guess that's probably because he was making movies in the 70s, and, you know, that's probably why he was in the wilderness for ages, because a lot of those filmmakers, like, you know, what, he was political at the beginning of his career, but, like, you get filmmakers like Brian De Palma or other people who sort of fell off,
yeah,
you know, in the, and then you get Scorsese, who politics have been in his movies, but he doesn't really touch on it, and his career still sort of maintains because he kind of has, you know, he's malleable to whatever film.
Yeah,
he has characters that question things, but he's not like Schrader, where it's, you know, in most of his work, like, Schrader isn't really as commercially successful as a Scorsese.
Yeah.
Is. I guess because Scorsese's more glossy than Schrader ever has been.
Totally, except, yeah.
Except for, like, maybe Mishima, but then Mishima's, like, a weird art movie.
Mishima is, like, his most visually striking film, but it's not, like, it's not accessible in the same way as most of Scorsese's films. Although, actually, you know, it's kind of similar to Raging Bull, at least in the black and white segments. It's fractured autobiographical style. They're not identical. They're not the same type of film, even within the biographical subgenre. But that, you know, that you can see that maybe there's a touch of Schrader in Raging Bull that he carried on into Mishima. But that's an astonishing film. That's absolutely.
Yeah.
I think, yeah, he probably.
It might be my favorite of his films. It is.
Yeah.
Fucking, yeah. It is a really good movie. And he is a filmmaker who likes to reckon with people, you know, like. Because, like, I don't know his opinions on Yukio Mishima, but like, he does like reckoning with people who, as an audience member, you wouldn't like as a person. Like, he likes to tap into brains of, you know, people in society who, you know, people would call outcasts, sometimes for good reason. You know, Travis Bickle is someone you know but, like, he's definitely one of those American artists who's like, I'm just gonna go to areas people don't want to go to. And I guess Blue Collar does do that in a way. Like, it is trying to talk about, you know, stuff, you know, about the average working American that most American film doesn't want to talk about.
Yeah, it's like, okay, maybe unions don't always work for the working person, but at the same time, there's more to it than them just being, like, a wing of the mafia.
Yeah, like, there's no scene in the movie where they're like, we should get rid of this union, like, you know, because, like, as I've said, like, they like the union, they're just disillusioned with how it's being run.
Yeah.
And, like, and the disillusionment comes from the fact that they're in a union and they feel they have no say in that union. Like, which, if anything, is, like, a radical statement in that, like, yeah, they're the members who should have a say. Like, everyone in that room should have a say, like, and, like, they shouldn't have their, you know, problems, even something as simple as fixing a locker, pushed to the back, you know, because it is impacting the lives of, you know, the members. And I think that's an interesting statement in and of itself.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm happy to see that, as with the Card Counter, in his next film, Schrader is returning to naming films after the profession of the protagonist. So Master Gardener, I'm not sure when it's going to be coming out, but it stars Joel Edgerton as Narvel Roth. Fired across the bow of the Marvel losers from another one of Scorsese's peers.
To be honest, the name of the character in Card Counter, William Tell, is such a fucking... He called his main character William Tell.
That's so good, yeah. Schrader's just like, you say Marvel, I say... Narvel.
Also, Schrader's one of those guys who can pull off doing the same ending like multiple times.
Yeah.
Like I'm pretty sure Card Counter has the same ending as Light Sleeper, but even then, that's like the ending of apparently a Bresson movie.
Oh yeah,
like Robert Bresson's like his favorite filmmaker. So, like, he just does the pickpocket ending every time.
Well,
you know what? If it ain't broke, don't fix it.
Actually wasn't Schrader's original ending for the Taxi Driver script, but the addendum that Scorsese himself added to Taxi Driver, where he becomes a media celebrity, he just repeated that ending for King of Comedy.
Yeah.
So he recycles his own endings as well.
I'm so shocked Schrader didn't write King of Comedy.
Like. I know, it's obviously a masterpiece, but it is kind of derivative of Schrader style. But,
yeah,
you know, I'm not complaining, one of my favourites.
But King of Comedy is almost like a bit more of a light-hearted Schrader.
Yeah, it's a bit more of a comedy than Schrader.
So I can kind of believe he didn't write it, because if you were a King of Comedy, you know, Rupert Pupkin would have killed Jerry Lewis in that movie.
Yeah, Well, maybe Joker is the Paul Schrader version of King of Comedy.
And that's the end of the first part of this episode and the part that's on the main feed. Once again, thank you very much for listening, and a huge thanks to Conover Production as always. And if you like what you hear, as mentioned at the beginning, you can always sign up to our Patreon for as little as £5 a month to listen to the full thing, as well as the full backlog of all of our premium episodes so far, and many more to come. As mentioned, there's going to be 2 Patreon episodes a month moving forwards, so do sign up, and thank you very much. See you all next time.
TV demo. Swing my hammer strong.